This podcast is offered by Jikoji Zen Center on the web at jikoji.org. Our programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
Well, good afternoon, friends, here and elsewhere. Thank you for joining. So today, here, in case you forgot, it was Valentine's Day. We had a lovely chocolate heart at our breakfast table, which was very sweet. And so in recognition of the day, I thought I would talk about the first and the ninth precepts. Encouraging life, respecting life, and cultivating great friendship. I've done a few times, studied with my teacher, Angie, the Platform Sutra and Weening's commentaries on the Diamond Sutra. And I really always love this immediately about Weening, no matter who came to see him, and people of all kinds did, of all stations, a lot of people in the Chinese government at the time, and well-off people, but also very ordinary people, as came to see Shakyamuni Buddha also. And he always began each discourse, each talk he gave, with good friends, you know. And so he just acknowledged that anyone who comes to hear the Dharma is a good friend. Even if they come out of simple curiosity, why not welcome them as a good friend? And that's one thing generosity is about. Why not welcome everyone and everything as a good friend? Of course, that's sometimes tricky, but we'll try to say a few words, and you will feel in your own life how to do that. Great friendliness is a translation of what's commonly known as the Metta Sutta, which we chant here every day to remind us of our good friends and how generosity works in the world. It's a beautiful expression of it. So metta in came across somehow, I don't even know how, some of these early translations like enlightenment were very clearly, or I remember how they came about from certain ministers who came in touch with Buddhist teachings in Asia in the 19th century, and they didn't know what metta meant, so they just assigned it enlightenment rather than more like awake or awakening. But metta itself, translated as loving kindness, according to Pali scholars that I've studied with, they say it's really great friendliness, and loving kindness puts it's a nice way to express it, but it's not the kind of love that, it doesn't have to be a deep love or a kind of a familial love, or it does have kindness in it. But great friendliness gets to welcoming everything. So I like that translation. So sometimes it's seeing the opportunity to express great friendliness. As I mentioned, quoting Dogen the other day, one should not miss the right opportunity. And sometimes it's just a smile or a kind word. The Taoists say a true smile is a sign of love. So it has a long history, smiling does. And it's a transmitter of energy, a warm healing effect. So the Taoists were very much concerned with or aware of relating the inner and the outer oneself and the outer world. They were very attuned to that. And they had this view that that welcoming a smile would bring health and happiness and longevity to the person who smiles. As well as we know this because we're born with a smile, whatever, what the smile reflex, let's call it. We're born with that. It comes in, baby smile. And there have been a lot of studies about that, how that works. But, and including generosity, how infants, researchers do everything with cameras these days, and so they'll put the babies in a room and without their mothers, but with other babies, and they will give each other things. They will put out a few toys, baubles, and whatever, pieces of fruit. I'm not remember all the details of that study, but babies will just naturally give it to one another with a smile and receive it with a smile. So this is pretty deep. And it's good to remember that. And also the Buddha smile. There are many, many icons and depictions in many forms of Buddha, in statues and paintings, and but often they have a smile. And if you look at the Jikoji Buddha, that Buddha smile is there. And I learned, and not before I practiced Zen in insight meditation, we were encouraged to, as we sat down to meditate, just put that little, just tilt the corners of the mouth a bit. And that's also been studied a lot. Maybe the Westerners have come to it a little late, but they've really jumped into it. And it does affect our neurology. It affects our brain, our emotions, when we do smile and when we have that little smile. So it's a nice thing to remember once in a while, like when you sit down, especially as the days go on and the body becomes tired, and maybe even the mind becomes tired. Sometimes a little smile, a Buddha smile. So I encourage you to look at the Buddha if you haven't gone really up close and looked at Buddha here in this room. So the ninth, so that's the positive, the ninth, the first precept, that's the ninth precept, but respect and encourage life is the positive aspect of do not kill, sort of the negative way to put it. And that can be, ordinarily we don't think of ourselves as killers, and most people who come to places like this are don't kill and don't take life, at least wittingly. But sometimes there are those, but sometimes we do. And then, of course, this is a whole big topic. There are lots of gradations. And I remember Angie saying, you know, people asked her early on, like, well, what about, you know, veganism comes up, or vegetarianism, or things like that. And she would say, well, you know, there's no getting around taking some form of life. Even plant life has its life. And we do that in many ways. We take trees, we take, we're part of this whole that contains everything, killing and not killing. And yet, of course, we each make individual choices to refine our lives. And that's a good thing. And there are consequences on every level for doing that. So we each need to see for ourselves what our heart says about how we want to address this conundrum of being alive and not existing. Every time we breathe, we take in microorganisms. If we get sick, do we take antibiotics, which kill those microorganisms? Now, I have met a couple of people who've said that they don't. So that is a choice. So I can tell you a story of my own. I grew up in the Sonoran Desert of Arizona and grew up with a real conditioning around insect and creepy crawly creatures, which was what, you know, wise of my parents, because there were scorpions and for small children, and there were snakes, coral snakes, rattlesnakes, particularly the most deadly, tarantulas, spiders. I mean, every kind of insect I was told to keep away from. And not only there were mosquitoes, which were hard to keep away from, and I was and still am highly allergic to them. So there was a built-in auto response to seeing mosquitoes. But when I was I think I was 20, and I was going to college and living in an apartment by myself, I came home from work one evening, and there was this, I don't know how it got in, but there was this huge moth in my apartment, and it just freaked me out totally. I mean, I really got the chills. I'd never seen anything like it, and I thought, what is this? And I thought, well, I don't know, but maybe it could be something that, you know, it looked big enough, if it landed on me, it could bite me. Or it just had this conditioning. And I remember being paralyzed. I don't know how long, but should I kill it or not? And so this was the first time that I'd ever actually had that thought of my relationship to this other creature. It was also very beautiful. And then I found out later it was a Polyphemus moth. I kind of looked it up. So I ended up killing it with a broom. And I felt so bad. I felt really sick. And yet that was a transforming moment for me. At that moment, I just didn't kill insects, but tried to avoid them. Oh. So whenever we, you know, sometimes we have those moments when we have a deep conditioning. As I mentioned, our conditioning goes way deep. And before we have the capacity to understand it, especially when we're young, already in this human birth, but even before that, just the DNA we carry with us and our reactions goes very deep, but it can be a transforming moment. People have had those with seeing movies about the way animals are killed too. So just something to be aware of, that there can be that switch. The ninth precept is actualizing harmony, sort of the opposite of no killing or respecting and cultivating life. It's not the opposite of that, but as the precepts go on through the 10 in the positive formulation, actualizing harmony, that's awareness, and that's tuning into compassion in a way. And that's what I remember feeling like, well, that was alive. So that was kind of not a very sophisticated or deep form of compassion, but I just really got that was alive. And now through my action, that is gone. So tuning into compassion, what I've found most useful is feeling where you feel that in the body. So all these emotions or more subtle states, compassion is perhaps a separate category because it's not a raw emotion like anger or love, but it's a more subtle form. But we can feel it in the body. Where do we feel it? In our heart, in our eyes, perhaps, it could be anywhere. Different people have different bodies and they feel things. Some people feel things in their spine or at the back of the neck. So, and the negative form of the ninth is to don't be angry, no anger. And so anger arises very quickly because that's a deep-rooted emotion based on our DNA fear kind of. People have done a lot of studies on that too, the lizard brain, etc. So things which the prefrontal cortex can't easily take a hold of and access. However, sitting down and helps us access those states, and not in the way of the prefrontal cortex, perhaps, but helps us get it in the body as well. So anger, where does that arise? In the stomach, in the head, also could rise in the chest area, the throat. So another way of saying not be angry, abandon anger. Just if we can tune into it, if we pay attention, then we have a chance to make that choice to find some way to let it go. We can turn our attention to who or what triggered that response in us. What was it that was said or done? And there can be anger at oneself too. What did I do to myself or to something? What mistake I made? If it's a big mistake, sometimes we can be very angry at ourselves. But that's not really... it's not really very helpful. That just creates the cycle or continues the cycle on. And it's also not helpful to feel guilt about any of these negative emotions. We talked a little bit the other day about the second arrow. That's just adding more trouble on for oneself. Bill mentioned the other day when we brought that up that that there's another piece to that of instead of getting more angry with ourselves, we can note when we notice, we can turn to an intention of not repeating that action of anger. So anger and takes many forms, irritation, impatience, and everything we do spills over to others, the smiles and the anger does. So we can see how that plays out in societies. And that is part of human history as well. Janton brought that up the other day. We go to war and we keep going to war. So that's how deep that response to life is when others aren't doing what we want to or when we feel threatened by others. So how to meet these not being angry, or how to meet killing or taking life in some way, because it's not only killing the taking a life, but it's also killing other people's joy or other people's good feelings. It's putting people down. It's that kind of response we can have, and that's on us. So we can notice that when we do that. Speech is can be a big form of anger, and we'll talk about that a little more on another day. But as best we can to channel that energy. Anger has a very strong energy. And sometimes we think it's uncontrollable. So that tuning into that subtle awareness, which our Zazen practice allows us to feel what in our thoughts, what is, if we have a thought that's a little bit we don't like somehow, and maybe even a thought about, kind of an angry thought about a situation or a person, what does that feel like in ourselves? Just when we're sitting down by ourselves, nobody's saying anything to us, doing anything to us. That's when we can really tune into that. And not in an analytical way, but actually feeling where that resides in the body so that we can recognize it. Because it happens so quickly that we don't have time to think it through and analyze it in real life. So when we get a little experience in channeling the energy, then we can turn to a more positive thing. And I've just, this has been my experience for a long time, that positive results do not arise from negative energy. There's some people ask the question about what about righteous anger? And there, that's, you could say, well, yeah, I could channel that, you know, I'm really feeling like it's wrong for our society to do this. This is a place where it's pretty easy to get, to feel like this is wrong and we have to do something about it. But how to turn that into a positive, how to do something positive rather than moving from the place of negative, that never works. There are many things we can do to help others. There are many things we can do in society that can help others. We can just, the list goes on. From even political action, it can be a positive thing. Or helping the homeless, or helping anyone in any way, doing what we see that we can. And maybe we don't have the means to do that, or the time because of our work or family obligations, but just recognizing that moving the energy toward the positive is a great benefit to us and to the whole world. So another little gatha from Aitken Roshi. When people show anger and malice, I vow with all beings to listen for truth in the message, ignoring the way that it's said. And I think I quoted something like that from memory when Mariko asked a question about how to respond. And I said something like, well, it's contextual, it's hard to give a way to respond, but actually there are ways that you can respond that are more general. Like if you're in a personal relationship or even a work relationship, any kind of relationship, you can ask, well, I didn't understand what you said, or I'm not sure what you meant by that. Or could you tell me a little more about that? Or if it's someone you're really close to, what are you feeling? What are you feeling? It's you have to be careful because you don't want to say, well, what are you feeling? You know, of course. So that's the positive energy. But those kinds of responses like that, you know, and they're often helpful in with people that you don't know, you know, well, to say, well, I'm not sure I understand what you mean by that. Or just, I'm not sure I understand what you mean. And then, you know, you may not get the answer that you'd hope to hear. Like, they just repeat what they said, only louder and stronger. You could say, I'm sorry I don't see it that way, or I can't really respond to that because it doesn't really resonate with me. So you will have to come up at a certain point with one's own phrase. Everyone has to come up with their own responses in the moment, but there are a couple of ways to look at that. So another one of the positive ways of looking at no anger, the ninth precept, or don't be angry, is equanimity. So that's another, you know, big word that, what does that mean? So in early Buddhism, indifference is the near enemy of equanimity. So that's something to look at. So instead of just shutting oneself off when you're feeling angry, or when you meet others, particularly when others are being angry, or you don't understand why they're saying that. And you just dwell in, that's that person where they are now, and bringing in some compassion if you can, saying that's just, you may remember, often for me, it's like, I've been in that situation. I know what that person's feeling and why they're expressing it that way, because I've done that too. And that allows the compassion to arise for me. And then once that arises, then it's easier to speak or just to be with. Sometimes you have to walk away. So there's compassion. That's another big word. And I also remember Angie talking about idiot compassion. So, you know, when people are doing wrong and when they're threatening you or others, I mean, you can't just say, well, that's the way they are right now and I'll be, no, you have to use some discrimination, some discernment, wise discernment, and point it out if necessary, or do an action that, you know, grabs somebody out of harm's way. It can be very radical, actually. But it's equanimity is recognizing that we're all just working with our human being selves, which are complex and not all as well understood as we ourselves would like, and we would like for others. So another way to say equanimity is not taking things personally, depending on the situation, if it's not really threatening or not bothering you, then it's not an affront to you personally. It's always a good thing. It's not about you, in other words, or me. It's not about me. It's about them. That's where they are right now. And that's the way it is right now. So that life brings us those situations all the time. So all this is not easy, but it's true. And especially the part about not taking things personally, not putting yourself in the middle. There's another phrase that I consider Buddhism in a nutshell: don't be selfish. If we could just not be selfish. So I'd like to end today so we have time for discussion, dialogue. This is really a dialogue process for me in this role that I'm in. I really think that's how we learn from each other. Perhaps I've already quoted this because I quote it all the time. Shanti Deva, one should be a student of everyone. One should be a pupil of everyone. So I'll end with Nyogen Senzaki again, because he just had such a circumstance when anger could arise, or when hatred. He was in the middle of a war. He was sequestered. He was in a concentration camp. And he was leading the Japanese Americans who were with him, those who wanted to, and many did, in practice. He was a monk and a priest. And so I'll read another poem by him. This was February 18th, 1945. And it also, he was commemorating Parinirvana, as we are today, for this week. On his deathbed, Buddha taught his disciples to practice forbearance. Man should act like the willow branches, which bend gently against the wind. Three times we have commemorated Buddha's Nirvana Day on this plateau. We did not learn much during the past 3 years. We are ready, however, to face the world with equanimity, taking smilingly the snowstorm of abuse, as well as the sunshine of honeyed words. Praise be to the Buddha, the Enlightened One. So I thank you for your attention, and I welcome your words. Anton.
Thank you for your talk. I have a question. You mentioned anger, and I'm curious, like, if during the practice you feel some feelings that are close to anger. As you said, they're like many relatives, like maybe like you can, like not enough patience or something like this. What are good questions to ask to learn more about what is it? if it's even a strategy.
Is it even which, pardon?
If it's even a strategy to figure out, like, asking questions to this.
So the questions to ask yourself.
Or the anger you feel.
Or the anger you feel.
Yeah.
Who is feeling this anger? That's the first one. Who is it that's feeling this anger? Another good one is, what is this? What is this anger? What is this feeling of irritation or impatience or whatever it might be that you're feeling in meditation? Who is it? What is it? That's a whole practice in Korean Zen. What is this? What is this? That's a practice. Allison.
So you did mention we are seeing a lot of anger arising in the world. And I wonder whether our own curiosity about where that anger arises from can be helpful, especially in my line of work. Can you talk about trauma-informed care? And one of the first ways to encounter somebody who's angry, and then the stakes are high in the healthcare setting, let's say, is to, instead of asking in your head or even directly, what's wrong with you, is to ask the question, what's happened? And I think that opens kind of a curious, it's that heart connection I think you alluded to or said directly yesterday about that way of building a connection with the other person of heart to heart. What's happened? And now you're coming alongside that person in the space of where is that deep value that's causing that anger to arise?
Thank you. That's beautiful. I like that phrase. What's happening?
What's happened?
Or what's happened? What's happened? Or what's happening either could be, you know, what it's going on. Anger leaves a residue usually. Well, any strong emotion does. Continues a bit. And so that's another, that reminds me of, I have a friend who's a Dharma practitioner and a psychologist and she sometimes uses in her work, well, what are you feeling? That can be, that also depends on the skill of the questioner, but what, I really like the simplicity of what you said. Thank you very much. Bringing that in. It's another skillful means. Upaya. Pamela.
Thank you for the talk. Anger's a potent subject, I think. And I have a son who's a psychiatrist and with whom I've spoken about anger. And one of the things he has said to me is that you can't skip it. You can't skip anger in the grieving process. You can't skip over anger. You have to, at least I have to, make friends with this. So when I hear something that says, no angry, I feel like, well, no. I feel like I have to allow this anger and acknowledge it. It's offerings really acknowledge what it has to offer. In my experience is that I have to allow my anger. And I think a lot of women of my age, if you have gray hair, you're my age, are taught not to allow themselves anger. So I'm not saying that we should act on it. That's a different animal, I think. But I really appreciate that you also mentioned in this talk about making friends with these strong feelings that come up and knowing how to behave wholesomely with them requires, I think, going through them, not shoving them away. And so I just want to make a pitch for allowing them in, especially in practice, just to, I like Allison's reference to walking along with someone, walking along oneself, that this is, well, for me, this has been a life-changing.
Allowing them, yes, making friends and being curious about where they come from and where they... There is just so much conditioning, you bring that up too, in all of us in many ways. And so asking those questions, what is this, and getting curious about our reactivity in no matter what form it takes. And I think the no anger, yes, the prohibitory forms are often the no, and that just says, like, that flies against the face of what human beings are. You know, they are everything. That denies it, which is untrue, and that's what you're saying, that you can't. I don't know. I don't know about making friends. That's one way one could say it. And also it just accepting this is what is right now. And I am not going to push it away, but I'm seeing more deeply. And there may be good reasons to be angry. As I mentioned a little bit, there are reasons to be, there are plenty of reasons to, in our world, to be seeing things that are wrong and then finding the way. That's what our path is, trying to find the way of moving those, going through them, I think you said, going through them and with them into a positive direction. Yeah, the Bodhisattva path is rich in possibilities. Thank you very much for bringing that piece in.
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jokoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jokoji, please visit us on the web at jokoji.org.